sessions on health and wellness in the 21st century. I just want to take a chance right now to thank Holden Village and to thank Paul and Carol and Tom for inviting me back. Trish has been just great here, great her sense of humor, so thank you. Is Trish here? When you see her, would you thank her for me? She shows as well as anybody how to age gracefully and well, and just remarkable lady. Nancy, thank you very much for opening my eyes to a lot of things that I didn't know, and that's been very, very helpful. Jim, thank you as always. Your friendship, and your intellect, and your intensity is pretty dramatic, and I know why Jim's the way he is because his mother and my mother were in the same womb, in the same, they were two peas in a pod, as far as I can tell. Where's Don? Don. Don, it's always a pleasure. And there's nobody's got a better sense of humor than Don Coverly, except when he's making fun of me. And Gay, thank you for putting up with me. Thanks to all the new friends that we've made here. Keith has been very special. And I feel a certain closeness and sadness that we're leaving today and that won't be around. A couple loose ends about aging, that I didn't bring up. Education level is remarkable, and continuing education is essential. In the nun study, those nuns that continued to study and continued to learn new things did better. They were less likely to have Alzheimer's disease. So, the educational level earlier in life played a significant role. Whether you develop certain pathways in the brain that are going to be resistant to the degradation that occurs with Alzheimer's, so that even though the pathologic changes may occur, the manifestations of Alzheimer's disease may be very much delayed. Lots of studies in animals about fasting and starvation. We may not want to live to be 90 if we have to, weigh 85 pounds. There are eating disorders in youth that are very harmful to health, but there are also lots of evidence in animals, and certainly in some of the studies for people who have gone through prisoner of war camps or have been through great dislocations in societies, that longevity, it's a paradox, Jim, poor nutrition for a period of time. If you don't die of tuberculosis, some other things, if you survive and get through some of those periods, they actually are beneficial. Sort of like the paradox of exercise. While you're exercising, you have increased risk of dropping dead. But fortunately, nobody exercises 24 hours a day. So if you exercise just 1 hour, that's a bad hour. You get through that hour, you survive. Now, for the remaining 23 hours of the day, you are at lower risk than what you would have been if you hadn't exercised. So overall, your risk is lower. But there is a paradox, and one of the things you probably should not do if you're out, if you jog or exercise, the sprinting at the end is probably not good for you and potentially dangerous. That intense exercise, those last 200 yards I'm really going to put on, then I'm going to quit. That's where people drop dead. So, not a lot of people drop dead, but that's where it happens. So, yes, Nancy.
I have a question about the decreased caloric intake. Is a decreased caloric intake, hopefully, of a somewhat healthy diet versus malnutrition, like would happen in a camp?
I would certainly, if you were asking me, I would say a healthy diet with lots of fruits and vegetables, which give you a lot of, they're low calorie. It's the high calorie foods that are really bad, the donuts, those French fries last night. They taste so good, and we develop a taste for it very early in life.
Fat, salt, and sugar.
Yeah, those are three main food groups, as you know.
To avoid.
Humor is also very important, so that's something we just didn't emphasize, but it really, really is important. This Elder Hostel's in great. It's had a spectrum of art and poetry and geology. I like to think that medicine kind of bridges all that, because it clearly is founded in science, but it's founded in the humanities and a relationship with people and their mental and spiritual health as well. As a physician with the group here at Holden, I would have, if all you guys were my patients and you're coming in and you were asking for advice, what should I do? I would tell you one thing is to lighten up. Now, coming from somebody who's very intense and very serious about a lot of things, but who also likes to poke fun at people that are easy to poke fun at, like Dawn, this place is filled with a lot of very, very serious people, and that's fine, but I am not sure how healthy it is for physical health. Now, it may be really great. It's one of those things the body doesn't want to be disturbed. You know, we talk about in physiology, we talk about homeostasis. The body is constantly trying to take the environment and change it so that our temperature is 98.6 or 96.8 or whatever their temperature is. But it tries to get the temperature under control, tries to get the blood pressure under control. With the body's constantly, if we get too much salt, the kidneys get rid of it. If you eat too many calories, pretty soon you don't absorb it quite as well. So the body's seeking this homeostasis. What makes life interesting and fascinating from our brain point of view is to have challenges, is to travel to different time zones. Well, I just told you earlier in the sessions that going to different time zones might be bad for your health. The stimulation is probably not all that great for your physical health, but it's great for your mental health. So to try to get more equanimity in one's life. Now, some of the things that Nancy has taught and emphasizes are some of those things that bring us back to a more peaceful, quiet. But it really should be designed, not necessarily, I think, and I, of course, I'm out here on this spectrum of thought, should be designed to really accomplish those kind of things, which is to feeling the peace, feeling the comfort, feeling the blood pressure go down, feeling the breathing slow, not to become so intense and feeling that we're so challenged to some goal of perfection that we're so hard on ourselves. I think if we're hard on ourselves, it's not good for your physical health. So that's just my advice as a physician. So I would say do good works. I sound like Garrison Keogh.
You know, he had a slight stroke.
He had a stroke. Yeah.
So, and if you're good, whatever you do, do it well. Do it well. Make sure it's ethical or moral, and if it's meaningful, it's going to help you. Today we're going to talk about end of life. Two books I would recommend. Three books. The other one was Sherwin Nuland's book. I'm going to quote from it a little bit today about how we die. That's from a very physician point of view. Actually, all these written by physicians. But Dying Well by Ira Byock. Who's been the sort of a father of the hospice movement. Very sensitive book coming at it from a lot of spirituality in this. Bob Martinson is also a physician and a family practitioner and a medical historian. He's works at the National Institutes of Health right now. And his talks about a life worth living. So that's kind of interesting that we have the two Dying Well and a Life Worth Living. And if you die well, then that helps the life worth living. And if you have a life worth living, you will probably die well.
Are those in the bookstore?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
Are those in the bookstore?
Yes, both of these should have been in the bookstore because they were on the list that I sent up. All right. I want to just have a couple of quotations about end of life and aging and how things have changed. 60 years ago in the New York Times magazine, there was an article on recharting life for an aging America. That's 60 years ago. They weren't worried about the baby boomers then, but they were just worried about that people were living longer. And the author wrote, and I'm going to quote this, "To lead a long and happy life falls, for the average citizen, into the same category of irrational wishes as to be a millionaire or movie star. The reality is that most old people are lonely, poor, ailing, crippled, ugly, mentally and physically deteriorated." This was mainstream thought 60 years ago. I mean, we all look at that, oh, who the hell is this guy, right? He sure isn't describing us. And he was referring to anybody over 65. So, I mean, this is...
You're no more than half of those things.
Yeah. just to put that in historic, it's been a remarkable change. That 60 years ago, we didn't have bypass surgery, we didn't know anything about cholesterol, we had almost nothing for our treating high blood pressure. I mean, it's remarkable what we have done and what people, what kind of shape people are in at 65, 70, 75 than what it was while most of us were alive. But there's another side to that, and that is, out of the Hastings Institute, it said Americans today fail to accept that death is inevitable, or that patients appear to believe that death is optional. And although we all know we're going to die, as a society, we have really swung. We have really flipped from the way people looked at life and death and dying and aging two generations ago and the way we look at it now. And now, it's doctor, my knee hurts, let's get a total knee, my shoulder hurts, we get a total shoulder, my heart's going too slow, I get a pacemaker. I mean, we fix every problem. And aging, we look at aging, nobody dies on a death certificate. In fact, I cannot write this in the state of Oregon on a death certificate, old age. Doesn't matter if somebody lives to be 101 and then dies, I have to put down a disease as if they died of a disease at 101. Well, I think 101 you die of old age, whatever it was that was the final event. But we have reached a point where we don't even accept that as old age as a cause of death. Certainly societies years ago thought that was what was going to happen.
How about natural causes? Yeah.
I'm sorry?
How about natural causes?
You can't put down. There are no... If natural causes, you would live forever. You have to have a disease. Get that straight. I cannot bill you for natural causes. There is a book. There was actually a book published. It was The Last Healthy Man in America. And we have, is anybody here not have a disease? Can any of you think that you do not have a diagnosis? I mean, I have a diagnosis. I have high blood pressure. I just found out I have glaucoma. I got to put eye drops in now. So I have diagnosis. Did everybody else have a diagnosis?
I don't.
You don't have a diagnosis. You're the last. We got a few people that have. You don't have high blood pressure. You don't have high cholesterol. What's your cholesterol?
My cholesterol?
Yeah.
It was 199.
It's high. You have hyperlipidemia. Sorry, you just thought you were well. No, this is true. I mean, what we used to say 300 was a high cholesterol. We now say 180 because there's no longer whether you fall. We used to define normal and abnormal as being in the last 2.5%, two standard deviations. Well, we don't do that anymore. We don't do that anymore. We now have ideal, and if you're not ideal, you're abnormal, and if you're abnormal, it's a disease.
Ideal is for the 30-year-olds, isn't it?
For all you women who have had been screened for osteoporosis, mm-hmm. to find out whether or not you have osteopenia or osteoporosis, you have a lower bone density than what is normal, just say you're a 50-year-old person, and that you go get screened, and this is the number comes out from the machine. Now they will then compare it. Now who should they compare it to? Normal 50-year-olds, right?
Right.
You think they do? No. They compare it to women when they reach their maximum bone density, which is around the age of 30. So you
That's
are being, and so you could be 85, and they're comparing your bone density to the bone density of a normal 30-year-old. Okay. That's the way it's reported. So when you're two standard deviations below what they say is normal, it's not normal for your age, not normal for, it's normal for the 30-year-old.
That doesn't make sense.
And so we have medicalized the entire population. Now, it's a risk factor to have it. The lower you are, the more likely you are when you fall down, you're going to break you're going to break your hip or break a wrist or have a compression fracture in your spine. So there are some things we can do to lower that risk. And that's not inappropriate, but is it really a disease? Think about that for a while. So, you know,
so
what's a disease?
If it's named, it's a disease. Is a condition a disease?
To the medical profession, it
okay.
is.
Should you
think of yourself as being sick? See, a problem comes, then you stop thinking of yourself as being sick. But we're getting off on another topic here of just what is, how you define health and define disease. But it's kind of interesting the way, and it serves us, serves doctors and the drug companies and the medical industrial complex very well for have everybody think they're sick. It's not good.
I've got a friend who's 87, and 2 years ago they decided her blood pressure was incredibly high. And so they put her on all this medicine. I mean, she has this white coat syndrome. Her blood pressure is always high when she's in at the doctor's office. They put her on this medicine. She weighs about 100 pounds. She's a little tiny thing. And she was loopy from the medicine. I mean, she was way over-medicated, and her quality of life has just really gone down, but they went into panic mode because she had a new doctor from one she'd had for the previous, 20 or 5 years or so. And the numbers are lower now. But she's 87. I mean, I feel like she's still being over-medicated.
And you're probably right. Mm-hmm. You're probably right. I think our society is over-medicated. The good thing about it is that a whole bunch of people can't afford their medicine, so they don't take what we prescribe. So there is no. This is true. If people really did what their doctors told them to do, there'd be a lot more side effects and complications and all kinds of stuff. Anyway, in case you can't tell, I'm kind of a cynic. Quotation: Homer, the race of men is like the race of leaves. As one generation flourishes, another decays. And it's follows the same kind of thinking that was, so Homer, long, long time ago, Ecclesiastes, to every time there is a season, to every time of purpose under heaven, and a time to be born and a time to die. Historically, we have accepted that very well. Thomas Jefferson, who I mentioned before, and this is quoting out of Newland's book, where he's also he describes how people die, including what happens to you when you're hanged. You could skip that part if you don't want to. But it does give you information about what's the dying process like. I think we should know about that. I don't think we should keep that secret and hidden. If you're going to have cancer, what can you expect? So you can make a reasonable decision about what's going to happen. And I'll get into another quote from Newland toward the end. Of our time. But Thomas Jefferson, writing to John Adams, they became very close friends and exchanged a whole series of letters. And they were getting near the end of life, and Jefferson wrote and said, "There is a ripeness of time for death, regarding others as well as ourselves. When it is reasonable, we should drop off and make room for another growth. When we have lived our generation out, we should not wish to encroach on another." So that really talks, I think it refers to the seasons of life and accepting things and not necessarily hanging on for every last minute as if you get a prize at the end. Very smart man, Tom Jefferson. What we're going to talk about today, I want to give some definitions about things at end of life, talk about preferences, which is what we all want to. We want our family members and other people to know, and our physicians and the healthcare people to know what our preferences are, because we have lots of choice at end of life, a lot more than we think. There are legal and ethical constraints. I mean, I may say that regardless of what condition I'm in, if I can't do a certain thing, I want someone to kill me. I can't ask anyone to do that because they have to go to jail for doing what I want them to do. Or what I might choose them to do. So we do have legal limitations. We'll say a couple things about the Oregon and Washington Death with Dignity Act if you're interested in how that has played out. We've had almost 10 years of experience now in Oregon. And then I hope we're going to be compressed for time, and Gay and I and some others are heading down lake today, so we're going to be taking that early bus. just a few definitions so we know if we talk about things that we know what we're talking about. Everyone has the right to refuse care. That's part of the autonomy. That's an ethical principle that you have an absolute legal right. If you're an adult, you can refuse any care you want to refuse. You never have to do what some physician or nurse or somebody tells. Now, once you're in a hospital, you lose. It's like being in a prison. And the nurse on the ward is your prison guard. And you can't do, is that not right? Medical people? I mean, you know, in fact, the physicians can't do anything that the nurse doesn't want to do. We know who runs the show. I mean, that's their unit. And so you lose autonomy. So, if the nurse, you have broken ribs and the nurse wants to give you a bath and a shower and exercise you despite your broken ribs, you kind of have to do it unless you sign yourself out. You can always leave the hospital by signing out what's called signing out AMA, against medical advice. You just relieve the hospital of responsibility for what happens, but you can do it. Also, if you can't make the judgment, there's something called substituted judgment. That came out of the Nancy Cruzan case. There were a bunch of cases historically, and I think you've heard about them, and you may not know all the details, and we're not going to go into that. That would take an hour to talk about Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Cruzan, yeah. Terry Schiavo. No. Three people in which have gone all the way to the Supreme Court to make decisions about the end-of-life care for these three women in three different eras. One was in the 60s, one was in the 70s, and Terry Schiavo was just... It was all taking place when we were here, when I was here at Holden at the last elder village that I was at, which was in 2006. So it's very recent. So there's something called substituted judgment, in which case someone who is making the decision for you, whoever that person is. Now, it's nice that you have, if you've filled out an advance directive, that you have actually named somebody and had a discussion with them. But if you don't name them, it is very clear in every state what the order of decision making is going to be. And it starts off with your spouse. So if you're married to somebody and separated from them but never got divorced, and you hate that person hates you, and there's nobody else around, that person is going to, and you haven't filled out your advance directives, that person legally can make decisions for you at end of life. So you can name anybody you want. So some of the stuff about gay marriage is not entirely true, because if you name your partner to be a power of attorney, that person can make all the decisions, and that supersedes. In fact, a power of attorney supersedes a husband or a wife. So, like, I would never trust Kay to make the decision. I would have Dawn. I could do that. I mean, I would be immediately admitted not to the general hospital, but to the
you should see a psychiatrist.
To the mental health unit, you know. But that would hold up, and Don could make all the decisions, and Gay would say, well, he never wanted that. He never wanted to be whatever. And Don would say, it doesn't matter. I am making the decisions. He gave me the legal right, and that would hold up. Now, Gay could take that to court and petition and all kinds of things. But until the court ruled differently on that, Dawn would have with me.
Is that what actually happened in all those three cases?
No.
What
happened in those three cases, in every case that involved a young woman, there was no advance directive.
Oh.
That's the problem. So I am going to be beating on you people to make sure that everybody here has filled out an advance directive. In fact, I have the ones for Oregon. You could actually fill out an Oregon form and take it to Minnesota, and it would be legal. But each state has its own. You go to any general hospital, and they will have them. They have to have them by law, and they'll hand them out. But I've just got a few here if anybody wants them. But it's not for us that it ever becomes a problem. It's for your kids and even your grandkids, if the grandkids are 20 years old. They're the ones that need to fill out an advance directive. Because all the problems, they don't arise. I mean, no 85-year-old person with an end-of-life issue goes to the Supreme Court. I mean, they're all 85 themselves. So the problems arise in the young people, the people you didn't expect to die. or get seriously injured or have a brain injury, and then it's the question, do you disconnect the ventilator, do you pull out the feeding tube, do you even start some of these things? And it becomes, those are the difficult cases, and it's always where people in the family disagree. But not it's frequently, but that's the problem. But sometimes it's the family wants something done and the state wants something done differently. And two of the three cases came out of Missouri. Is anybody here from Missouri?
Originally.
You're from Missouri, but
originally.
You left.
Long time.
Arthur Kaplan, who is kind of one of the most famous ethicists in the United States, he's at the University of University of Pennsylvania, says that he travels everywhere to lecture. He will not travel through Missouri. If there's a connection through St. Louis, he will change the connection to make sure he goes through Chicago or some other place. And you know, a couple of the major, in fact, the Cruzad case was with Ashcroft. They have taken, in Missouri has taken a very, very strong stand against, I mean, they think us out here in Oregon and Washington are just murdering the old people like crazy. With a physician-assisted suicide. And that still is an issue. So that's just kind of an aside.
Not a lot of them, anyway.
Cliff, can I just bring up a point, because I know your time is getting short. I think
the time for our lecture is getting short.
I'll decide about that.
Yes.
I just think you need to stress and hammer home a little bit more to the group that it's much easier not to get put on certain.
Yes, that's my next point. Thank you, Gabe. Yeah. It's about withdrawal of care, and we had a discussion, a little small group one morning, about is it different from to take somebody or to remove the pacemaker or to remove an endotracheal tube, as opposed to not putting it in the first place. Ethically, there is no difference. Withdrawal of care is the same as refusal of care. But if there's an emotionally, it's very different. But from a legal, from an ethical, from a moral perspective, there is no difference. So if you did not want to get put on a ventilator, and you had indicated that to your loved ones, but the EMTs picked you up at Walmart when you had collapsed, rushed to the emergency room, we have an emergency room physician here, patient arrived, no information, they get intubated, they get resuscitated, they get put on a ventilator, family comes in and finds dad on all hooked up to machinery and everything, you know, and there he is, and he never wanted that, and had... You had the family been with the EMTs when they arrive, or they would not even call 911. Dad's dead and he's dying, and let's let him pass on to the next life, whatever it is. Is there a difference between never doing it or having somebody in the intensive care unit all hooked up and taking all those tubes out? Ethically, there's no difference. Emotionally, it's much harder to do. And anybody that tells you that it isn't, you know, hasn't had to do it. I'm sorry.
If they pick you up, they're required.
If they don't have any information. Now, you notice everything I have here is kind of like white or gray, except for this.
Hangs on the refrigerator.
This is, anybody, who knows what this is, besides Gary?
But I haven't made one out yet.
It's a POLST, a pulse. It's a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. Everyone, and this was initially developed in Oregon. Oregon has kind of led the way in end-of-life kinds of issues and public discussions. And Washington State's another state that's been very progressive on this. This is now available, I think, in almost every state. And what it is, and in Oregon at least, and I think in Washington, is it true? Do you have something similar to this?
It's green.
It's green. Mm-hmm. But, the evergreen state, of course. And of course, but the green one fits in Washington. You don't see it. It's camouflage. In Oregon, we really believe in it in Oregon. And it has some preferences. Everybody that's in a nursing home, everybody that's in assisted living has to have one of these. It has to be filled out. It's signed, and it's filled out by the patient, signed by the physician, so that it is a physician order. And what it essentially tells, it tells the EMTs when they arrive what they can and can't do. The EMTs are very, very reluctant to be called to somebody's home find Dad lying there on, you know, had last gasp, not, you know, heart stopped. And for the wife who doesn't have one of these, for the wife to say he didn't want anything done. The EMTs, because if they don't do anything, he dies. And then the wife says, well, that's not what I really said. And they must have misunderstood me, and they didn't perform their duty, and then there's a liability. So the so because of the liability to the EMTs and the hospital, they will. So anybody can fill out one of these. They can you can get a small version to have in your wallet. You can have one of these hanging on the refrigerator, and it will. Anybody who's had a serious heart problem, something that doesn't want to be resuscitated, would just as soon die quickly and suddenly if they do. Probably ought to have that because somebody's going to call 911. If you don't call 911, it's not going to be a problem.
Nancy Winder, who used to be the pastor at my church at Faith, if you had that, it's there's at least a copy in a file in the church file so that if people start quibbling, the pastor can say, no, this is what she said.
Yeah. The other thing, I just want to bring up a point. If you're with someone and they're dying and it's their time to go and everybody agrees it's their time to go, don't call 911 right away. Give them a little time, wait a little bit, then call 911.
Good point. Very.
Don't be in a hurry.
Very quickly, physician-assisted suicide, legal in two states, legal in now in Switzerland as well as the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark has something that's similar to that. First went into effect in Oregon in 1998. You have to have a terminal illness. You have to be able to administer the drugs yourself. You have to have two physicians agree that you have only 6 months to live, and you have to have a physician certify that you're not clinically depressed. So there's a bunch of safety things involved. And it has a number of people have requested requested the medications and have never taken them and have died of natural causes or whatever the natural, whatever the disease was. It's about one out of every 1,000 deaths in Oregon is a physician-assisted suicide. And it has stayed right about that, at that level.
What is that in people per year?
I could,
is it in the 30s or 10s or 30 to 40?
50, I think the biggest year was maybe 50 or 60 people. So it's not very many.
Thank you.
And there's been no influx. I mean, it was said, well, when we have it, people, everybody's going to, you know, from around the country, they're all going to move to Oregon and to die. Well, people move to Oregon. It's still such a fantastic state that they don't want to die.
They decide not to die.
euthanasia, good death, by definition, good death, is where a physician actually administers the drug. That is patently illegal in every state in the United States. It is not illegal in the Netherlands. It's not that the physician cannot, and you should not ask a physician to come in and give a dose of a paralytic agent or an overdose of a narcotic or a sedative to kill you, even though you might like that. Now, we do that for our animals, for our pets. We do that to our prisoners who are on death row. We don't do it for ourselves or for our loved ones. And it's the concern is the slippery slope. Who's making the decision and why? And if Dawn is making decisions for me, and when I was not myself one day, the signing that, I also signed over the insurance policies to Dawn. That wasn't a good move. So they, one has to always be concerned. There are ulterior motives, and sometimes the most loving family members have other reasons why they want Granny not to suffer. Okay? So it's better to be poor at the end of your life if you're worried about your kids making decisions for you. There's a condition, there's something called terminal sedation. Terminal sedation is where medications are administered near the end of life for the express purpose of comfort, to relieve pain, to relieve shortness of breath, to relieve nausea, to relieve whatever. If someone is having severe pain, one can imagine, and one's giving a narcotic for that, at one point the narcotic is going at the dose required is going to suppress breathing, going to suppress cough reflex, going to make pneumonia more likely. It's going to lower blood pressure. It may just lower the breathing altogether so that the carbon dioxide and waste products build up in the body, and it may hasten death. So it's a from the, you know, the ethicists talk about you know, it's a non-intended outcome of terminal sedation, which is to give enough medication that somebody is sedated to the point where they are not in any pain or any discomfort, and they usually are not eating at that point, they're not drinking at that point, artificial feedings are not continued at that point, and death is hastened. If the intent, ethically, if the intent is for comfort, then that is okay. If the intent of doing that is to hasten death and to kill someone, then that's not okay. At least that's not okay in the general ethical acceptance in society. That might be okay for any individual, as you can think about it. If they have a terminal disease, they're going to die within a few days anyway. Why not die in one day as opposed to 5 days? But it's been referred to, and this is the slippery slope, and this is all the ethical issues. It's been referred to as slow by some people, as slow euthanasia. So you can see what we're getting into, that the potential dangers and who's going to make those decisions. And part of the right wing attacking the Obama administration and the idea of death panels and all this kind of stuff and pulling the plug on granny is a legitimate fear that the government or somebody, whether it's an insurance company, the government, somebody who's paying the bill, will have an ulterior motive that it's better for granny to die quickly than to die slowly, because if she's dying slowly, and then Social Security payments continue, Medicare payments continue, whatever else continues, and that would otherwise end. So there is a legitimate fear in back of that. Fortunately, I mean, I don't think that that's ever going to be a major problem, but, you know, things happen, and societies go some very strange ways, and we only have to look back to the late 30s and 40s in Germany to realize how quickly a society that seems to be highly civilized can make decisions that, in retrospect, just look absolutely obscene.
Cliff, could I say one more thing? Could you talk about the old man's friend and refusing antibiotics at the end of life?
Yeah, I thought I did that with refusal of care, and that there are situations. Maybe we were having a private discussion a little bit before this. You may reach a point when you're in a nursing home, or just in your life, that the quality of life is such that you elect, and you make it clear to everybody around you, that you don't even want to be treated for pneumonia, or you don't want to be treated for a heart attack, or you just want your treatment to be one of comfort.
Or a urinary tract infection.
Or it could be, and that happens in a nursing home. And then, so people are in a nursing home. The most common thing in a nursing home is pneumonia. Somebody's old, demented, and they get pneumonia, and the nursing home doesn't want them to die there in a nursing home, so they pack them up, put them in an ambulance, send them to the hospital, they go to the intensive care unit, they get intubated, they're on a ventilator for a few days, they recover, they go back to that same horrible existence, which is horrible not by my judgment, but by their judgment. They really didn't, they never wanted to be in that. And what we've done is, why did we treat that pneumonia? Why didn't we let nature take its course? And I think we were talking a little bit earlier, is that it's and I don't know who I've been talking to now. I'm just talking. Must drive you guys crazy, huh? But one way, did we talk about 1850 here?
No, you talked about that with me.
I talked with you. Well, you talked to everybody else about
no,
that.
No, you
okay.
Do that.
I think it is, and not everybody might agree with this. When you're dealing with an old person that's demented or that has, you know, that has cancer, it doesn't matter what they have, but they have going to have a limited life expectancy, and they have a poor quality of life that they feel is a poor, or that they would have expressed to you years ago that they didn't want to be in that kind of condition. It is reasonable to transport yourself mentally, do a little game. How would I treat granny or grandpa or my brother in 1850 if we lived on a farm in central Nebraska, which was 45 miles from Omaha, 20 miles from some little dinky town, and 3 miles from my nearest neighbor. How would we have treated Granny, who was sick and demented and not doing, and just not doing? Well, we, you know, Granny would be there. We would feed her when she was hungry. She'd give her, we'd keep her warm and dry and clean. And when she got pneumonia, we would put her in bed and we'd keep her comfortable. We wouldn't be putting her on a ventilator. We wouldn't be hooking her up to machines. We wouldn't be giving her antibiotics. And that would be perfectly legitimate in 1850 or even 1950. And I think it's legitimate and reasonable now. And if you think it in those terms, that was an appropriate way to treat somebody then, and that's what they would want, is to go on to the next world and be kept comfortable. Yes, you've had experience with this.
Well, the antibiotic use is on the pulse form. So you can, I think it's on yours too, isn't it, for organs?
Yes, it is. Yeah. It is. Whether they want to be treated for those kinds of things. And if you fill out one of these things, it's going to be taken care of. But if you don't fill out one of these, you know, Only 3% of elderly people are in nursing homes and have these things, and the rest of us are out there, and stuff happens to us, and we're being taken care of at home.
I have a question. When you said that the young should also have those, how does that work? It would have to be the parents, say a 10-year-old?
Oh, no. I'm not talking about 10-year-olds, because the parent will make the judgment for the 10-year-old. A 10-year-old does not have to worry about this.
I mean, it has to be something amazing.
But I think everybody at the age of 21 and over ought to fill out. They may name their parent. It can be very simple. You know, my parent, if they're married, it's most likely the spouse. And so that's very clear. And they also can, and they can fill it out in as much detail, as little detail as they want. They may just say, I want everything done. At 20 years old, I can see how someone would say, do everything, and let's hope that 10 or 15 years down the road, it might be a miracle thing if there's some reasonable hope. So let me just, we talked terminal sedation, hospice care. There's a lot about hospice in here, and hospice is just great. I want to just talk a little, take 5 minutes. The difference between sleep, obtundation, coma, persistent vegetative state, brain death. Those things are different. So I'm going to kind of fly through that. Sleep is pretty clear. We know what sleep is. Somebody's lying there. They look like they're in coma, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so, and you know, and there have been people who have had electric shock put across their chest just because they were asleep. because they're in a deep sleep, and you know, somebody has thought they were dead or dying or something and came in and happened. That's happened to people. This happened in the hospital when the lead got disconnected and somebody would, you know, the nurse pushed a button and shocked them out of sleep. Obtundation is where you can arouse somebody, but they're not alert. They have an altered level of consciousness, and there's a variety of things. They may just moan and groan. They may just respond to pain, but they do respond and show some evidence of response. Coma is a potentially reversible state where you can't, it's like a deep sleep and you can't wake them up. But if you do brainwave tests and you do CT scans or functional MRI scans, their brain looks okay. Or they may look okay. There may be different reasons for coma, but it may look perfectly normal. You can't see anything wrong with the brain at all, except you can't wake the person up. And that may last for a period of time. People have waken up out of coma years later, waken up and actually been able to talk and communicate. No one that's been in a coma longer than a year comes out of that without some significant brain injury. Yeah, so if you read in the National Enquirer or whatever, you think about somebody was in a coma for 37 years, woke up and then went, you know, and you know, the guy was 20 years old then, he's still, you know, he's chasing girls and doing all the things that 20-year-olds do. It's not true. If they wake up, they have severe brain limitation, but they can wake up. A persistent vegetative state, now that's what Terry Schiavo had. That's what Karen Ann Quinlan. When Karen Ann Quinlan had it, that condition didn't exist because it hadn't been described. It existed, but medicine didn't describe it. But by the time Terry Schiavo had it, it was described because of our ability to image the brain so much better with CT scans and MRs and things of that sort. What somebody in a persistent vegetative state, and it can happen from trauma, or it can happen from an anoxic injury where you didn't breathe, you were in drowning. We see it in drowning victims. The heart comes back, but the brain has been seriously injured. You do not see evidence of cortical activity. So the brainstem activity, that controls breathing, controls temperature regulation, and its cortical is the thinking, communicating part of the brain. It's that layer it's the gray matter of the brain. Terry Schiavo, on her MR scans, had no cortical material left. People in coma, the brain looks normal. Terry Schiavo, when you hooked her up to an EEG, had no evidence of cortical activity. She had plenty of evidence of brainstem activity. The reptilian brain was working. That older part of the brain was working. It controlled the respirations. It controlled her temperature regulation, controlled her circulatory system. But she could not wake up. So when Bill Frist, eminent cardiac surgeon that he was, made a statement that he looked at the video and knew that she could wake up, he didn't know what he was talking about. He was just totally out of his field. Neurologist after neurologist after neurologist examined this woman, looked at the studies, and said there's no way she is ever, ever, ever going to wake up because there is no brain tissue to wake up. Okay, so that's called a persistent vegetative state.
Since her husband wanted to not continue.
Her husband wanted to not continue.
That's what I was asking earlier. Did the parents then go to court?
It went all the way to the Supreme Court. They even had a law, Florida passed a law, and it was called Terry's Law, and it passed almost unanimously in the Florida legislature, and it authorized Jeb Bush to put the feeding tube back in to this one patient. Mm-hmm. That was a law. It was declared unconstitutional unanimously by the Florida Supreme Court, who said you can't write a law just for one person. You know, it's phenomenal that anybody would ever do something like that. It'd be like writing a law for Dawn. Well, we would like to write a special law. So, and then there's brain death. And brain death is where there is no activity of brain whatsoever. So there's no reptilian brain, there's no control of ventilation. Brain death equals death in every state in the United States. You don't have to, and you can have a heartbeat, you can be hooked up to it. You won't be breathing by yourself, but you can have a heartbeat by yourself, but you have to be hooked up to some kind of an artificial ventilator to be declared brain, to get to a point where you can be declared brain dead. But to be declared brain dead, we have to have no evidence. So Terry Schiavo was not brain dead. We couldn't say she was dead, but we could say that she had persistent vegetative state. We could say that there was no chance, zero. There's a few things in medicine you could say zero. With her, we could say zero chance she was ever going to wake up. Her brain only weighed 45% of what a normal brain weighs when doing an autopsy. She just had a little shrunken brain. All the rest had been destroyed. And we went through, I don't know. And the legal system did not fail us. The communication between the husband and the family failed. The legal system, 11 decisions by the Florida Supreme Court, every one of them said, you can take the feeding tube out. Every one of them was then, the legislature got involved, everything, it became a nightmare. All right, I could talk forever and ever. I have just a couple things I'd like to leave you with. Again, quoting from Newland's book, talking about the Roman senator Seneca, who lived a long time. This is back in the Roman times, and he lived to be quite old. He was quite a brilliant orator. And he said, I will not relinquish old age if it leaves my better part intact. He was talking about his brain. But if it begins to shake my mind, if it destroys his faculties one by one, if it leaves me not life but breath, I will depart from the putrid and tottering edifice. The way you describe yourself at the end of life. I will not escape by death from disease so long as it may be healed and leaves my mind unimpaired. I will not raise my hand against myself on account of pain, for so to die is to be conquered. Interesting. But I know that if I must suffer without hope of relief, I will depart, not through fear of the pain itself, but because it prevents all for which I would live. Dr. Newland, from a scientific surgeon's point of view, what he says here, I could be saying to you, he just says it so much better. My clinical career, and that's over the last, for me, it's been 40 years, but Newland's been like 50 years, encompasses a period during which a realistic expectation first began to be felt in the scientific community that malignant disease would prove amenable to treatment based on an understanding of cellular biology rather than the ages-old oversimplifications of surgery. As more was learned about the cancer cell, new and increasingly effective ways were developed to combat its unchecked ravages. With the optimism born of therapeutic successes came a determined cockiness that sometimes goes beyond reason. It finds expression in the philosophy that treatment must be pursued until futility can be proven, or at least proven to the satisfaction of the physician. Jim brought up this whole issue about futility. The boundaries of medical futility, however, have never been clear, and it may be too much to expect that they ever will be. It is perhaps for this reason that there has arisen the conviction among doctors, more than a mere conviction, it is nowadays felt by many to be a responsibility, that should error occur in the treatment of a patient, it must always be on the side of doing more rather than less. Doing more is likely to serve the doctor's needs rather than the patient's. The very success of his esoteric therapeutics too often leads the physician to believe he can do what is beyond his doing and save those who, left to their own unhindered judgment, would choose not to be subjected to his saving. So that's heavy kind of stuff, but it's true. Physicians, you may not want to ask your physician for that advice at the end. It may really be a value judgment more than a medical judgment. And now that's really heavy, so to lighten things up, I have a poem. This kind of ties together all the science and the serious kind of stuff and how we die and all this with a little poem. I didn't write this poem. It's called Living Will. Take me off the tubes and hose. Stop the ivy as it flows. God forbid that I should live punctured like a bloody sieve. Respirator bags and dope. Chain me here where there's no hope. Free my body from machine. Let the end be quick and clean. Sense and spirit long have fled from the body on this bed. Send my organs to the banks. They will be received with thanks. What good reason can there be for prolonging misery? When my vital functions cease, let me go in grateful peace. Thank you all. You've been just a great group, and I really appreciate. I wish we had more time to.
Yes, sir. One thing that might be of interest is that people that live a long time, before they go into nursing home, don't spend near as much time in a nursing home as those that go in early. I've read that.
I think that's probably true. Thank you again.
Thank you.